west.
Okay, Representative Blue, I thought we'd start today with the general question of the evolution of black political activity in North Carolina since the mid-60s and the Voting Rights Act. You obviously graduated North Carolina Central in 70. You had been involved in various civil rights demonstrations and so forth, went on to Duke. And in some of your earlier interviews, you've talked about your choice of law as a path that would lead you in the direction of having some opportunities maybe to make a difference. The Bobby Kennedy and King assassinations in 68 had maybe shaped your thinking a little bit on that front, you mentioned. As you measured the political prospects, say, late 60s, early 70s for blacks in the state and more generally, how optimistic were you about those prospects?
I think in the late 60s, of course, let me preface that first. In the late 60s, the primary thing on my mind was finishing school and choosing a career as opposed to politics in general. I was certainly very attuned to what was happening at the national level in the political contest, the Humphrey-Nixon election and those kinds of things in the late 60s, even more attuned probably in 64 as North Carolina transitioned truly into the civil rights era. And those themes that reverberated, I think, throughout the state in the 1964 election, with Beverly Lake sounding the traditional segregationist themes that were so characteristic of campaigns throughout the rest of the South. And I guess it was sort of a wake-up call more than anything else as a high school student that I got, because it was relatively low-key laid back during the 4 years of the Sanford administration. You had no major racial confrontations in the state, certainly discussions and small skirmishes and stuff, but no major confrontations as you were beginning to have in Mississippi, you know, with the freedom rides and the various assassinations and burnings that were happening in the Deep South. Or for that matter, even the kind of confrontation that apparently had characterized Virginia or Georgia and the various other southern states. So by 68, you know, certainly very politically aware of the ramifications of the elections of various people involved in it to some extent. But that was not something that got my full attention full time. I was upbeat, I think, as the themes started to change in the late 60s from hardcore civil rights to other issues, Vietnam, women's equality, and those kinds of things. I was upbeat that we were in a progressive mode and that things would tend to work themselves out in relatively short order. I think that the thing that really dawned on me, Joe, is that as a college sophomore in 68, and having arrived in Durham when things were really hot and very interesting, when within a week upon arriving on NCCU's campus, you were pulled into meetings and forced to make choices, notwithstanding fears and concerns that you may have of arrest records and things like that, you were forced to make choices and forced to sort of look at the moral underpinnings of the choices you had to take sides. And so anybody who arrived in Durham in the mid-60s, or pretty much any college town where there was a major black college, usually was going to make the choice to immerse themselves into this movement and get involved. And the only way that you could do that is to sort of be upbeat, know that it was going to make a difference and you were going to change attitudes and change things. So if I had to characterize the way I felt 68, 69, I'd say I was upbeat, thinking that blacks would move into the political mainstream, be able to be elected to office. Remember again, and I'll go back to 68 sort of as a watershed year, with the all of the activity with McCarthy running for president and Bobby Kennedy running and trying to recapture the spirit of Camelot, yet talk about how we were going to move as a society, talk about the themes that were reverberating then. You know, you're still talking about voting rights. You were talking about civil rights. You were talking about opportunity. And all of those themes were around at the time. And on the other hand, I think as much as it's not talked about now in the dormitory rooms and in the student union and in the other places, we were constantly discussing whether the Nixon candidacy was basically an effort to roll the clock back. And so one of the things that that sort of riveted that period into my mind was the first the King assassination. We had been in many marches and demonstrations in downtown Durham before the brick throwing began. I mean, peaceful marches up and down the old Fayetteville Street through the black neighborhoods, a sense of camaraderie, a sense of community, a sense of common purpose, talking with young people in those neighborhoods on voting drives and various things like that, voter registration drives. You had to be upbeat. And the thing that the King assassination did, I think, is sort of drop the curtain and make you take a sort of a reality check and determine that, you know, it's still very dicey and very dangerous out here to advocate equality and advocate those basic fundamental things that people had espoused 200 years ago in the founding of the country. And so you still had to be determined and to work hard at it, and you had a lot of attitudes to change. But even in the face of that, I think most of us were upbeat, thinking that we were going to substantially change the general climate in the country, and it would truly be an open society from the standpoint of everybody having an opportunity to participate. Following the demonstrations and the bedlam and the riots that came in the wake of the King assassination, you know, within a month we were back on target again, looking at some broader things. And I was beginning to think that I wanted to do something other than spend my time, giving theories of higher level mathematics and stuff. I loved mathematics. I was in the sciences, mathematics, chemistry, physics, and those areas, and I truly loved what I was doing in it. But there was this nagging thing in the back of my mind still telling me that, you know, you need to look at some other things, because there is a great potential to have an impact. And I guess by the time Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June of 68, my ideas had started to crystallize pretty much, and I was even more convinced after then that it was going to take a real effort, but there truly would be opportunity for full participation, and we were on an upward climb. King's quote about the arc of justice bending ever toward freedom, I forget which book it's from, but that kind of thing kept us upbeat. I will say that that year I did follow it because we had looked at the Humphrey campaign. He had come to Greensboro to campaign in the early fall. And so, you know, Henry Fry came on the on our radar screen, if you will. And with Henry's election, there were a lot of articles written and, you know, a big ado about the first black guy to be elected to the General Assembly in the century. And so you started thinking, yeah, this begins the march. And now one, but pretty soon many others, and the same thing will apply to the Congress and various other places where blacks are being elected. You were beginning to get blacks elected as mayors in major cities. So all of that came together as things that we started discussing in rap sessions and dormitory groups and in other places where, you know, college students got together.
Did the Reginald Hawkins gubernatorial race in 68 make much of an impression on you?
In the sense that I knew Reginald was running, in the sense that we all knew that he had about as much chance of winning as that proverbial snowball, but also in the sense that it was a declaration that we're independent, we can make our own choices, and it played very well with students, although you didn't get the vote out the way that one would have expected, but it was something that made students start thinking and start talking, especially black students on black college campuses, and start thinking that, you know, why not? Why is it that you have to meet certain criteria. I grew up Presbyterian. Reginald Hawkins is a Presbyterian, so you sort of know what he's doing in that context also. So there were many of us who watched, with some sense of approval of Hawkins' campaign, and again, on the college campus, a lot of students were talking about it and were involved in it. But from the standpoint of practical politics, I mean, all of us knew that it could get us excited, but it wasn't going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Somebody who's an emerging black political leader in those years whose prospects looked quite different, I guess, would have been Howard Lee. I mean, he won two terms in Chapel Hill, and then in the early 70s was consistently being noted in described in the press as the state's leading emerging black political figure, became the second vice chair of the party, so forth. And he runs in 72 for the Congress. Were you involved in that race?
No, I was involved in being a hard student, a serious student.
But by 76, you're one of his campaign chairs.
Yeah, involved. I was his campaign chair here in Wake County, but as a result of that, since it was the prime target county, ended up taking on greater responsibility with the statewide organization and almost became a full-time volunteer. The day our daughter was born, on July 1, 1976, almost a 4th of July baby, a bicentennial baby, rather, for the 4th of July celebration, I was with Howard Lee down in Robeson County in Pembroke campaigning. and I spent most of the summer during that. Kanika was born. My daughter was born early that morning. Within 30 minutes after she was born, I had run off from the hospital after I'd taken Earl over there. Kanika was born. I ran off from the hospital, grabbed our son, who was then 3 years old, and on the way to Robeson County with Howard Lee. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was very much involved in that sense. But in 72, you know, we had a lot of other things developing. Mickey Michaud was running in Durham, and some of us were involved with the law school crowd trying to see how to get Mickey elected. And the debate at the state level was about working people and about, not to the same extent, but to some extent about blacks getting more involved with the Wilbur Hobby making his run as a labor candidate, and Skipper Bowes and Hoshauser and stuff. But we were still looking at some of the themes from the 60s, but they were beginning to change tremendously by the 72 election. There was an assumption that there could be as much participation as people were willing to go out and create. And so the focus turned on registration efforts. I mean, I was involved in some of those, but actively involved in Howard's 72 congressional campaign. No, I knew most of the people who were, primarily because Durham was not in the Durham was in the second congressional district. It was Durham and Chapel Hill, and Raleigh was not. Raleigh was the fourth. It was Durham in the fourth with us. I forgot, but anyhow. I was not directly involved in the 72 campaign, other than, you know, passing the word on when I could, but and observing. But I thought that was upbeat enough that it showed that, you know, again, if Reginald could run for governor and Howard could run seriously for the Congress, it still was on the upward incline. Howard's chance of winning the Congress were far greater than Reginald's were of winning in the governor's race, and far greater than Shirley Chisholm's were in winning the presidential race. So it was a progression, and again, consistent with what a lot of us believed would begin to happen.
Mm-hmm. When you arrived in 73 for your three-year stint at Sanford Law Firm here in Raleigh, you quickly got involved in local Democratic Party politics. Can you tell me about how sort of some of the details of your early involvement, the sorts of things that you did here in local party politics?
Well, when I first moved to Raleigh, when we were first coming here in 73, Clarence Leitner, was running for mayor. Again, an upward progression of black candidates doing things that they had never done before. And it was the first election of a popularly elected mayor. Before that time, the council had done it, or the council had been reconfigured, rather. And so Clarence was running as the first serious black candidate to try to become mayor. So that was galvanizing everybody, bringing a lot of young people together. The influx of new people to Raleigh was just beginning in earnest. And so this campaign was bringing those people together, and I joined a law firm that was highly political. Partners in the firm, former governors, folk running for the General Assembly, former party chairs, Hugh Cannon, and all of those various people who had been very active, Bob Spearman, who had been active, as a Carolina student during the mid-60s. And so we just had an office full of people who were politically aware and politically active, and, there was no second-guessing about it. You had a responsibility, although nobody was going to beat you over the head with it, to be politically involved. And so within 2 or 3 weeks in the firm, I hit the ground running, knowing that the campaign for the mayor was taking place, but also the community itself, Joe, started sort of reaching toward new people coming in, saying, you got a responsibility to be involved. And so within the first few months here, there was a woman who was a county commissioner. She wasn't at the time. She was on the school board, Elizabeth Cofield, and her husband, James, who were very politically active. There was a guy named Jim Shepherd, who was a writer for the Carolinian, the local black newspaper, and a realtor, and the first cousin of the James Shepherd, who was the founder of NCCU. Those kinds of people, along with Ralph Campbell, who was very active in the Raleigh Wake Citizens Association at the time, those kinds of people were sort of casting nets, catching new young fish, if you will, who happened to swim into the territory. Emphasizing to me in the conversations that I had, you got a responsibility to put some time back in and help us develop this community and help us develop political leadership and political activity. All of that in conjunction with Clarence's campaign. And while you may not be involved in the hierarchy or structure of the campaign, we got some things to get you involved in. And there were political divides beginning to develop, not really divides, different interests that people wanted to pursue at the time. And so I fell right in the middle of that within 6 months after bringing my wife and son here and moving here to begin practicing law.
Can you give me a quick synopsis of the story of the Wake Black Democratic Caucus and its division with the more traditional or more established, Raleigh Wake Citizens Association over the Cannon-Coggins race?
Yeah, that was a time in coming. A fellow now who is still the local president of the Raleigh Apex branch of the NAACP, Henry Pickett, who is a Baptist minister, was a young fellow, a little bit older than I am, but Pickett had been working closely with Cofield. In fact, one other little note about James. James was in the courthouse the day I got sworn in just to see who the new folk were. Constantly was in communication with me after them. But anyhow, the Cofields, and the Leitners and Campbell and some of the more traditional folk had a slight falling out because of some of the support in the 72 election cycle and 73 election cycle. So they had gone out and started having discussions about a broader group that was not looked so much at in a nonpartisan way, but a group that truly was about advancing the interest of blacks within the Democratic Party hierarchy, both at the state level and the local level. And so Cofield and those were very involved in that, and Pickett was the chairman of it. I got involved as a new lawyer and got a lot of the other young folk in town, new folk in town involved, and ultimately became the chairman of it in 74, a year after getting here, and organized it, again pulled in mostly young people, under 30, under 35, and probably 300-400 strong by the time we finished the organizational effort throughout the city and county, that started recognizing something that the traditional organization, as well as the traditional powers that be, had not looked at, either the white power structure nor the black power structure. And that is about half of the city's black population lived outside the predominantly black neighborhoods, quite unlike Durham or Charlotte or Greensboro, for that matter. That, up to 50% that had moved in had moved in different places and truly was integrating the city at a much faster rate than most other cities in the state. And because of the way the area was settled initially, had little pockets of folk. And although they were black neighborhoods, they were surrounded by white neighborhoods, so they would be dispersed throughout those white neighborhoods, changing the makeup of precincts. Say Oberlin, over here in West Raleigh, or there was another one, Method Community, which was a traditionally black city just on the edge of NC State, outside the main black community, but sizable enough to impact the white communities around it, and all of the development in North Raleigh. So what we did in organizing those various areas of the city and still having a presence in the traditionally black area with a tremendous number of organizational efforts is basically out-hustle the traditional organization. Probably quadrupled our membership compared to what theirs was. And the energy level and the excitement and the sort of progressive bent on the people who we were pulling in was such that it overwhelmed anything around it. And so in the 1995 elections, the traditional liberal community abandoned Leitner as the mayor, primarily because of allegations against his family. I mean, he hadn't really done anything wrong. It was an uneasy feeling, I think, even with his election. And so the traditional liberal and progressive white community abandoned him. And by that time, the Black Caucus was beginning to have its own strength. I mean, by 75, it was a recognizable organization controlling the results of the elections, not only in the predominantly black precincts, but in many other precincts across the city, and dealing in coalition politics, going under the leadership of the traditional progressive liberal white organizations and coalescing with the younger white people who also had this forward-looking view of where the state and the country was going because they had been educated in the 60s and had been part of the civil rights struggle to some extent. I mean, not out in the streets and stuff. And so with Leitner's defeat in 1975, it left a void for leadership in the black community. Of course, we had Winters, who was had just recently been elected to the Senate, and had Cofield move up to the commission and Malone replace her on the school board, and still had Knight on the city council. And so the thought was that there needed to be a more aggressive approach to participation and inclusion, and there needed to be a dialogue among equals, not a dictation to by you know, liberal groups and stuff to the black community. RWCA had not maintained its active role in identifying the issues and prosecuting those issues with the larger community. It was beginning to look at it to some extent. Larry Wallace, a young fellow who had, I guess Larry was a couple of years younger than me, but Larry had grown up here, had gone to Vanderbilt and Harvard Law School, and had come back. So since I, as a young lawyer, was heading the Black Caucus, Larry then was tapped and chosen to head the RWCA. And for a brief while, there was a little competition, but not very much. And then we started realizing that we had to be on the same frequency. And besides that, we were great friends. And so as we started moving that, the 1977 elections appeared on the horizon. All of us had been very successful in the 76 elections. I mean, the Democrats won straight up the ticket from Jimmy Carter on down. But as we started looking at the 77 elections, Coggins had been totally unresponsive to the issues and concerns of the younger people in the black community, as we felt it to be, had not really mouthed those kinds of things that he should have been mouthing to show support for the kind of agenda that we had developed, both on employment issues, education issues, development issues, and those kinds of things. So the traditional community was unwilling to support any candidate who was the product of the traditional black community, was unwilling to support any candidate who was the product of the old white liberal coalitions
the old progressive groups, as they were calling themselves at the time, but generally the liberal components and the moderates in the white communities throughout the city. And as a black caucus, we were looking primarily at where you stood on the issue, your ability to organize and lead, as well as the ability to have an all-inclusive kind of administration. And so we picked Cannon because she said the right things and looked like she was going to do the right things. And we split very violently with RWCA, and we won. When you win, you've always done everything right as you look back on it. And quickly we realized that the victory was somewhat hollow because there was a lot of feeling that she had not responded to some of the real genuine concerns that the community felt. So that split lasted about 5 or 6 months, and by 1978 the two organizations were working in tandem, doing joint endorsements, joint interviews, joint statements, joint research and everything else, and so we managed to pull them back together. And in about 78, I had decided to make a run for the House of Representatives. And so the transition and the leadership of the organizations meant that all of us were beginning to move to something else. And so certainly that split between IWCA and Black Caucus had been smoothed over, and we moved on.
And I take it cost you no particular, or there were no particular cost to you personally in the as ramification for.
In fact, I think, as a matter of fact, it enhanced mm-hmm. me personally. I think mm-hmm. that first it taught a much deeper respect to the leaders, the older leaders of the city, and some of the resistance to the Black Caucus may have been from the more established, older leaders in the black community, as opposed to, say, some organization or other individuals. And I think it was just the standard feeling that you get when outsiders are coming in, maybe taking too much of the lead. But anyhow, by 1978, not only had we had the contest about the mayoral race. My name had been bandied about, and I was popular enough and known enough to have become a serious candidate. I will say that in 77 there may have been a little fallout, not a lot. I lost 6 or 8 votes in the executive committee from some folk who may have felt badly about that and consequently lost the appointment in the executive committee to the House of Representatives to fill a vacancy. But by the time I started my campaign in 78, most of those folk, at least publicly, had jumped on board. Now, in the end, as we went back and analyzed it, in the end, in late 19, or at least late spring 77, in the primary.
Mr. Blue?
Yes.
Your wife is on
three. You were.
We were talking about, you had asked me about any negative ramifications of the split. Looking back on it, in retrospect, some folk would argue that the reason I lost the primary in 1978 was that some people had lingering hostilities toward me for having led the coup, if you will, by the Black Caucus over the IWCA and the other traditional white organizations in the city and county.
You didn't miss by much.
I missed by 100 and some votes out of 50 some thousand cast. I mean, it didn't bother me. It just made me more. Yeah, it just made me more determined to run again. Some folk came on late, didn't come on as enthusiastically as they could, but they ultimately came on, and that's what a campaign is about. So I'd like to think that there weren't any serious ramifications, at least no long-term ones.
Give me a quick sketch, mid-70s, of your sense of the major black political leadership across North Carolina.
Clearly, in 1976, it was Howard Lee. I mean, his run for lieutenant governor established him, at least during the time that he was running, as the premier black leader across the state. As a premier progressive leader across the state, because McNeil Smith had been out and he had been looked at as a progressive. And Howard, having prevailed in the first primary in that race, moved himself into the premier position. I think that by the time the fall elections rolled around,
other people were beginning to emerge. The black legislators, Mickey Michaud, Henry Fry, were the primary ones. Joy Johnson, and although Richard Irving was there, Mickey, Henry, and Joy, especially Mickey and Joy Johnson, were very, very forceful and strong advocates for black concerns. So throughout the black communities, they were sort of looked at as the spokespeople. Mm-hmm. You started to get, in a political sense, Howard was still a very important part of the mix, but a whole new breed of us started coming along, young people at the county and local levels who were very involved in a lot of the discussions statewide as to what was going on. But the top leadership would have been Mickey and Joy and Henry Fry, and even Howard Clement was playing a major role at that time because of his involvement in Durham and his involvement with the Democratic Party statewide. The Durham people were very involved, and they had statewide followings. You know, Lavonia Allison, Stewart was very influential, but in a sort of background capacity. I knew all of these people because I was going to the meetings and participating. Ruffin hadn't emerged as the sort of go-to man on these kinds of on black affairs. John Larkin was Jim Hunt's minority affairs director, but John didn't have nearly the inroads into the players in the mid to late 70s. That Ruffin would later develop with those people and with all of us. But those were the major people on the scene. And again, a lot of them were, I guess, legitimized by involvement in the Hunt campaign. And many of them took positions in the Hunt administration. And so they had tremendous influence. But at the same time, a totally new group of black leaders were emerging, a younger group of black leaders, or a group of black leaders that included older people who had changed their way of thinking and were thinking some of the young ideas, that is coalition and inclusive politics, and not so much deal-making, but sharing equally the power that came through the political process.
Let me extend that thought. I wanted to ask, here you're late 70s, you begin to move towards your what will be a long service in the General Assembly. Did you have something back then that you could have described in so many words as a coherent political ideology?
Oh yeah, I think there was a coherent political ideology, and that was 95% of the blacks that you would talk to at the time, and realize now that we're just now talking about getting a significant number of players into the political equation. The late 60s and early to mid 70s produced the people in the pipeline. You still didn't have a lot of people in elective office, especially in North Carolina, because the redistricting stuff during the 70s had very little impact on North Carolina as it did the other southern states, and a lot of that was because of the lack of confrontation that you had in North Carolina during the 60s. You know, but Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, and all of those places, they had started drawing majority-minority districts. That had not started to happen in North Carolina. In fact, when I was elected, it was in an at-large district setting. That's what we had primarily throughout North Carolina. County commission level, city council level, although the councils were beginning to change and have majority-minority districts, but most of those lawsuits hadn't been brought. So you had the people moving into the pipeline, people of my generation, and people a generation ahead of me who had, you know, been toiling in the vineyards for a long time, positioning themselves to answer when the call came. And so I'd say generally by the late 70s, the feeling was that we had to become much more aggressive to get more people in elective offices. Started talking about, you know, more judges, more local office holders. When I was elected in 1980, there were three black members elected to the North Carolina House of Representatives that year, and one to the North Carolina Senate. And everybody knew that those numbers had to change, and everybody knew that it would be painful to change them.
But the roadmap had been pretty clearly marked. I mean, what had been happening in the other southern states clearly had to happen in North Carolina to ensure that kind of participation.
You've sort of described a political strategy. I actually was interested in a personal, interested in that as well, but would like to draw you out on the question of your own personal political ideology, your understanding of how politics has shaped what it ought to do, what your role in that effort ought to be.
Are you asking me whether that was pretty much formulated during the late 70s or whether there was consensus on it or what my individual one was?
Your personal
one. Okay, by the late 70s, it was clear to me that politics could have a much more profound effect on things, and I'd realized even as a student studying it some and looking at it, because getting close to it, seeing firsthand what a governor who was really committed to meaningful change and participation could do, or an administration, not just a governor, but Council of State and his secretaries and the other folk, having watched it at the local level with a mayor, I mean, being able to elect a mayor and pick up the phone and pretty much say, you know, this is, it isn't going right, and this has to happen because it's the right thing to do and stuff, changes your perspective. I mean, you're no longer looking at it in a vacuum. You're a practical politician, and you can see what a political decision can do to a specific problem and how it can alleviate that problem or create a more serious problem. So my political philosophy had been pretty much set in the sense that my whole view or vision of what government could do by having an inclusive kind of philosophy was that it was probably absolutely necessary to have some intrusion of elected people into some private affairs to make folk move this ball further down the road. A political philosophy also of negotiating and gaining some and giving some, the old art of compromise. You move away to some extent from the purist attitude that you would develop in school or as a student when you're looking at it, to one of practicality and reality. So if it's that sense that you're asking about, yeah, I had evolved through that point by the late 70s as I was preparing to be elected to the General Assembly.
Let me ask you two questions about that first run of 8 or 10 years in the General Assembly, the decade of the 80s. Redistricting and the Democratic leadership and how it came about that the Maverick coup emerged. So let's take the latter first, if we could. Can you sketch for me, Lisson Ramsey, Billy Watkins, how the House was run, how the Democratic leadership operated, and how it came to pass that the circumstances developed that Maverick was able to move through to speaker?
Understand, and I'll cover the period. That's the easier way to describe it. But from 1981, when Liston became speaker, through the time that he was out of office, probably as speaker, you talk about Democratic leadership. There was no formal Democratic organization in the House. I mean, the House was Ramsey and Watkins, and lesser players that they would name from time to time. I mean, I think Al Adams was an instrumental player in the first two Ramsey administrations. I think that Liston included people, but included them to a certain extent. But there was no real democratic organization, no real democracy. The governor dealt directly, when the governor was Jim Hunt, he dealt directly with Ramsey and Watkins, and I guess Royal in the Senate and Jimmy Green in the first term. And the decisions were made as to what would happen, and that's what happened. You know, there were various efforts made to sort of let people know what was going on, but ultimately you knew what was going to happen. And by the time Jim Martin became governor in 84, Jim Martin was not really interested in having other people involved. His mission was solely to and I think he would admit, was solely to build the Republican Party. So he was trying to create confrontation and confusion, and did a pretty good job of it. But even his contacts, when he wanted something done in the General Assembly, it was through conversation with Watkins and Ramsey. I don't think I got a call from Jim Martin the entire while
he was governor, and I was a rank-and-file member, even a committee chair, a judiciary committee chair. I chaired a budget committee during his first 4 years in office. I don't think I got a call from him on one particular issue. And I will say that at least with the Hunt administration, although the deal was set and you knew what was going to happen, the governor's folk worked the individual legislators a little bit better, and even the governor did because of the political implications of a legislator in your own party. So with Jim Martin, I mean, the deal was from a participatory standpoint, whatever he worked out with Ramsey and Watkins. And then he would get the Republicans to go along with it, or at least he would get them to fight it so he could make a confrontation obvious. The Speaker's organization, I guess, within the House would get the rank-and-file Democrats to go along with it. Now, I think that some very good results came out of the Ramsey era as Speaker. I think that we did some tremendous things for workers, for consumers, for average people. We, in fact, had a very progressive agenda on minority issues, but a lot of that was brought about because of the Legislative Black Caucus in feeding into Ramsey and Watkins what had to happen. So Maveritic was able to seize upon discontent by a lot of members who thought they weren't going to move any further. And, you know, in legislators you get these tremendous egos. And it wasn't so much that he was going to do anything better than Ramsey did it. He might give the perception that he was, give a perception of openness, give a perception of group decision-making rather than a decision having been made and passed on down. But more so than anything else, the Maveritic coup was brought about generally by Jim Martin and the Republicans. And that's what it was designed to do, to basically break up the old Democratic stranglehold on running the legislature. And so when, you know, Joe got 40-some Republicans and 15 Democrats who maybe one or two of them had played some leadership role in the Democratic House, but the rest of them hadn't played any leadership role and hadn't really aggressively tried to. I think that's probably what set the stage. The skirmishers with the governor, with Martin, that is, had convinced the public that it was a good old boy network in the House, and that anything done to throw the rascals out was a positive thing without regard to the kinds of policies that might be adversely affected by that. So people had a couple of years to think about that, and by the time we rolled through the first 2 years of Martin's second administration, people started thinking that the substantive issues did matter, that form was not really more important than what ultimately was going to occur. And I don't, you know, and Joe, while he had great ideas and I think was instituting some pretty good reform in the House, could not be forgiven for having taken the king's head off. That sort of came home to roost to him as he started looking to the next election.
Mm-hmm. Before we turn to the question of your tenure speaker and so forth, I want to visit the issue of redistricting.
Okay.
How it evolved across the 80s, people like yourself, people like Leslie Winter, people like Lonnie Guineer working on it up at the Inc. Fund, mm-hmm. How they thought of it then, sort of the philosophical question, how to best represent a permanent, identifiable minority in a majoritarian political system, and then also how it's worked in practice.
Okay.
Your perspective.
In 1981, I tried to redistrict the state of North Carolina, that is, the state legislative districts, without splitting counties, and tried to do it in such a way, you know, if you look back on it, that we could have some districts that truly could elect minorities. I was convinced at that time, again, because of the progressive nature of elections at the time, at least what I thought was the progressive nature of elections, I was convinced that all of the multi-member districts in the major urban areas could elect minorities. After looking at the numbers and the voting trends and stuff, I was just about convinced that I was wrong in that initial belief. We had elected, I started looking at it, and I was the first African-American elected. I was the first African-American elected in this century to the House of Representatives. Well, you know, there'd been a bunch of seats in the delegation, at least since the 60s, after Reynolds v. Sims and Baker versus Carr. And there had been some very good candidates who had run. Joe Sansom and other people had run for the House of Representatives to get a seat in the delegation. And I, as I looked at it, I wasn't smarter than they were. I mean, I didn't have the resources that they had, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and got elected to one of six seats, which, by the way, was about what you could draw if you had drawn out a separate district anyhow. So my view was colored somewhat by my personal experience. And I figured that at that time in the early 80s to simply carve most of the black people out of the at-large district would guarantee no more than we already had, and that was one minority district. And it would substantially change the philosophy and the views and the voting habits of the other five people who were carved out. And I started looking at it from the standpoint of Cumberland County, Guilford County, Forsyth County, Mecklenburg County, the other major urban counties. And when I looked and saw that in Guilford County, where Henry Fry had been elected, that they could not consistently elect a minority in that at-large district, which was six members also, the same size as the Wake County district. In Mecklenburg County, where there